In the world of James Bond, Spectre is the acronym for a mouthful of vengefulness, the special executive for counterintelligence, terrorism, revenge, and extortion. But since it doesn't quite add up, what in fact occupies the foreground is the ghostly word Spectre, this third-party organization which holds together the screen versions of Dr. No and From Russia with Love, but is without mention in those novels, is in every sense a haunting projection that at the end of his career, Fleming sought to reclaim, own up to, or release. Because the legal complications that had Thunderball surrounded deferred implementation of that made for the screen work, Dr. No was the first Bond novel to hit the screen. In Dr. No, as in From Russia with Love, the second Bond movie or projection, Spectre was in full force. In the novel From Russia with Love, in which the opposing force of evil is the Soviet organization, SMERSH, Bond's assignment is to get hold of a Russian cipher machine, clearly modeled after the Nazi German Enigma. The novel calls the machine Spectre. The screen version says Lector. When Bond's boss, M, extols the plan as the most important coup that's come our way since the war, he lets slip what remains most alive, even as dead, in the Cold War setting of Fleming's narratives. A close look at the novels shows that this recent past of the Cold War presses all over the place in the details. In addition to a number of recycled Nazis, the enemy organizations that Bond must battle include leaders whose menace is hard to identify, and whose German surnames could double as so-called German Jewish names, Blofeld and Goldfinger, who in the book goes by just Gold when he's alone with his gangster cohorts, coming from the Fort Knox Gold, are just two or three examples. Consider the dossier on the leader of the communist underworld in Fleming's first novel, Casino Royale. His name, the Chiffre, he himself adopted to go with the passport number he in a sense became when, while registering as a displaced person at the end of World War II, his amnesia didn't lift. This man, whose only recorded origin in June 1945, is as inmate of Dachau DP camp in the U.S. zone of Germany, is given a close description in search of broader origins. Ears small, with large lobes, indicating some Jewish blood, racially subject is probably a mixture of Mediterranean with Prussian or Polish strains. As freelance third-party operation that manipulates the Cold War conflict between East and West to obtain benefits of its own, Spectre makes a crowd of World War II ghosts, while also setting the father's missing place. Ian Fleming's father, Valentin Fleming, was killed in May 1917, fighting the Germans. Toward the end of his career as the author of James Bond narratives, and thus in the close quarters he gave himself with Spectre for making reclamations and reparations, Fleming compiled and published a tour guide in 13 chapters for the adventurous titled Thrilling Cities. Toward the close of the Berlin entry, Fleming jumps the gun in a slip or typo that identifies with the enemy. From this grim capital went forth the orders that in 1916 killed my father and in 1940 my youngest brother. Ian Fleming thus makes a date for his father within a range of German planning and issuing of orders, which doubles as the span of the death wish. That only the first date is tampered with shows that both father and brother are in it together, with the relationship to the father appropriately bearing the brunt of murderously mixed feelings. Once we arrive in Vienna, Fleming as tour guide turns up the contrast of the city he dislikes to recall with the Tyrol, where he lived with substitute parental guidance following his father's death. I learned German in the Tyrol from Mr. Ernan Forbes Dennis, who was a student of the great psychologist Alfred Adler, and I learned far more about life from Ernan than from all my schooling put together. The Tyrolese even ended up remaining his favorite people in the world. Through Adler, Fleming gained entry to greater psychoanalysis, the whole diverging spread of all that took its departure from Freud's silence. According to Thrilling Cities, Vienna in 1959 displays an utter lack of the intellectual and cultural activity that had defined the city, like Berlin and Munich too, before the war or Hitler's rule. Fleming attributes all these shortfalls to the absence of the Jews, who create an atmosphere in which the intellect appears to flourish astonishingly. At Blofeld's introduction as the mastermind behind Spectre in Thunderball, we learn that his charisma is of the same unbounded kind that alone explains how Hitler could have enthralled the most talented nation in Europe. From the German perspective of his identification, Fleming looks across a centuries-long generation of intelligent life, both Jewish and Gentile, both emigre and silent majority, that was utterly lost without the backup of proper succession or substitution for a long time to come. This circumscribed Germany-centric framing of the view to a killing belongs among the conditions for the existence of Spectre. If the recent past as introject inside Spectre appears in some instances as amalgamation of persecutors with their victims, then we must conclude that in that traumatic era from which Fleming derived the bond, there is no room for sentiment. The denizens of Spectre are shaken, not stirred. Fleming's decision, comparatively late in life, to marry because he was expecting fatherhood coincides with the onset of his authorship of James Bond. It was to bind his anxieties about the family complex he was entering, or returning to, that Fleming started typing the first sentences of the first Bond novel, from which all the rest would follow. The scent and smoke and sweat of a casino are nauseating at 3 a.m. Then the soul erosion produced by high gambling, compost of greed and fear and nervous tension, becomes unbearable, and the senses awake and revolt from it. James Bond suddenly knew that he was tired. He always knew when his body or his mind had had enough, and he always acted on the knowledge. This helped him to avoid staleness and the sensual bluntness that breeds mistakes. At this opener, we already have two or more settings juxtaposed. There is the den of iniquity, which shakes up as a brink of exhaustion, equal parts Christian soul care and secular concern for nerves or psyche. But then we switch to a body or mind maintenance program that prompted the first critical readers of Fleming's novels to identify Bond as the new cybernetic hero, whose relationship to his interiority as clean and mean machine is covered by the 00 icon, which in certain countries signifies the public restroom. Keep it flushed. This is the aspect of the Bond that will give way in its purity before the emergence of Spectre out of the initial juxtaposition of settings of spiritual and psychic exhaustion. Married with child, Fleming became the author of spy thrillers that drew on his wartime work for British intelligence, that were engaged in the Cold War, the native habitat of their genre. His literary day job was with the Sunday Times. Fleming proposed, as a series to appear in the Times, Reflections on the Seven Deadly Sins by 7 distinguished authors. In the foreword to their subsequent collections book of essays, Fleming slides into the James Bond mode of worldliness and gives us the stiff upper flip-off that the original 7 are by now outmoded, replaced by new and improved sins, with one exception, which also belongs to the world of the Bond. Of all the 7, only sloth in its extreme form of acedia, which is a form of spiritual suicide and a refusal of joy, has my wholehearted condemnation, perhaps because in moments of despair I have seen its face. In You Only Live Twice, a novel in which Spectre is busted or put to rest, Blofeld looks back on his thwarted attempts to be kind through threatened cruelty. In Thunderball, he sought to extort great sums of money in exchange for the atomic missiles he had stolen and was prepared to detonate in selective locations. But he was thus also providing work of caution that would have prepared the world to adopt the necessary defensive and preventive measures in the face of inevitable rogue appropriation and deployment of weapons of mass destruction. His next scheme, in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the open declaration of bacteriological war against Britain, if funds weren't forthcoming, might have forced the people he was threatening out of lethargy into the kind of community effort we witnessed during the war. This third time around, Blofeld has set up a castle of death in Japan, its gardens stocked with poisonous plants and lethal reptiles and insects, allegedly for research purposes. But the fortifications and the shark-infested moat, like the large signs prohibiting trespass, instead advertise to countless persons seeking death the true garden of ending it. This time, Blofeld is neither committing nor threatening any overt crime. His inadvertent service at first sight is to offer a more efficient means of disposal for the suicidally inclined. But once paid off to move away, which is the goal of his implicit blackmailing of the Japanese government, Japan will have been taught a lessening of the cultural valorization of suicide as an honorable way out. In this final incarnation of Spectre, for which Blofeld no longer needs its name or allegorical caption, the mastermind has taken up residence in the close quarters of the deferral of his own suicidality. "I will make a confession to you, Mr. Bond. I have come to suffer from a certain lassitude of mind, which I am determined to combat. This comes in part from being a unique genius who is alone in the world, without honor, worse, misunderstood. No doubt much of the root cause of this acedia is physical, liver, kidneys, heart, the usual weak points of the middle-aged. But there has developed in me a certain mental lameness, a disinterest in humanity and its future, an utter boredom with the affairs of mankind." In Fleming's Thunderball, Bond was the last to believe in the existence of Spectre as a third party to world conflict, rather than, for example, just another front for Cold War hostilities. In the next novel, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Bond is already 1 year into the assignment he was given to confirm that Spectre was in fact dismantled. Because he has all along been convinced that there was nothing left for him to keep after, find, or lose, he has determined at the start of the novel, since he appears to have been in effect relieved of his 00 duties, to submit his resignation from the service. When Fleming launched the Bond series in 1953, he set the superhero at an age and in a condition of health that would qualify him for retirement in another 10 years or so. Fleming was thus on this schedule too when it comes to Bond's relationship to Spectre. Before Fleming begins opening up in Bond the adult profile of mourning or depression, he sets the novel going with Bond's involuntary memories of early childhood by the sea. According to the history Fleming took down of Bond, the agent licensed to kill lost both parents when he was 12 years old. It was all there in his own childhood, spread out before him to have another look at. But after two more sentences immersed in time's passage, Bond, fast on the inoculative intake, pulls the emergency chain. Impatiently, Bond lit a cigarette, pulled his shoulders out of their slouch, slammed the mawkish memories back into their long-closed file. At the same time, he is keeping watch over his last night stand, Tracy, who is again contemplating suicide according to the terms of the contract with her dead child, which he has taken out on herself. Bond's intervention will lead by the end of the novel to their union and matrimony, following her stint in a Swiss asylum, working through her grief. To get to this point, Bond too must work through the pre-edible plotting of Spectre via Girls from the UK, Blofeld regresses to infancy for post-hypnotic suggestion. Though Bond succeeds in destroying the Spectre operation Blofeld restored following his defeat in Thunderball, Blofeld himself, now referred to as the Big One, gets away. In the wake of this getaway, Tracy calls Bond back to the onset of responsibilities. "You don't seem to think it matters to anyone, the way you go on playing Red Indians. It's so, so selfish." Bond reached out and pressed her hand on the wheel. He hated scenes, but it was true what she said. It never crossed his mind that anybody really cared about him. But now, in 3 days' time, he would no longer be alone. He would be a half of two people. Now, if he got himself killed, there would be Tracy, who would, at any rate, partially die with him. That Bond is only playing Red Indians is the disparagement of his agency with which his antagonists regularly taunt him on the wavelength, as we know from his bouts of self-recrimination, of Bond's own superego. Dr. Shatterhand, the pseudonym Blofeld will assume in the next novel, You Only Live Twice, is the old citation or introject of playing Red Indians in the German language world. Karl May introduced alongside Binetou, the Indian chief object of identification, his good white friend and ally, old Shatterhand. Thus the Germanic niche or crypt of Fleming's parental bond of couplification and mourning, the shattering of the and, continues to summon his special agency for final reckonings. While Mr. and Mrs. Bond drive to their wedding night, Blofeld and Irma Bunt, revealed in this parting shot for the first time as the other couple, drive by shoot Bond's partner in complication and successful mourning. Just prior to this conclusion, Bond had extolled to Tracy the main attraction of their first stopover, Kufstein in the Tyrol. Bond put his mouth up close to Tracy's ear and told her about the most imaginative war memorial for the 1914-18 war ever devised. Punctually at midday, every day, the windows of the castle are thrown open and a voluntary is played on the great organ inside. The novel You Only Live Twice, which already in its title reverses and preserves the ghost logic of mourning, according to which you only die twice, commences as therapy for James Bond. Sir Maloney, the neurologist attached to the Secret Service, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for his Adlerian-titled study, Some Psychosomatic Side Effects of Organ Inferiority, counsels M to find for his special agent a mission impossible that would inject upward mobilization into his grief-struck metabolism. "I don't mean necessarily dangerous, like assassination or stealing Russian ciphers or whatever, but something that's desperately important, but apparently impossible." Because Dr. Shatterhand's research establishment is strictly legal, but also because the Japanese are paralyzed before their biggest symptom, in which they cannot intervene, because it is the open invitational they already occupy in Cathet. Bond is offered as rescuer in exchange for Japanese cooperation with Britain's efforts to restore the crumbling range of influence of its secret service. His host in Japan, Tanaka, initiates Bond into Japanese culture as the refined gathering of senses and verities immersed in finitude. His appointment to this task comes out of the mix of his heritages. Educated in the UK, Tanaka nevertheless took the side of his place of birth in World War II, all the way to the inside of preparedness for the kamikaze defense. The success or significance of Bond's assignment, which requires that he go undercover, depends on Bond's assumption of a Japanese identity and identification. In what amounts to their last prep session on the way to the location of Bond's assignment, several breakthroughs take place. The day begins with a visit to Japan's oldest brothel, which, now that prostitution is illegal, remains open as a historical monument. Bond asks how many bedrooms there were. Only four. That's no way to run a whorehouse. You need quick throughput, like a casino. Bond, Tanaka says, has missed the point. In former times, this was a place of rest and recreation. Food was served, and there was music and storytelling. People would write tankas. Take that inscription on the wall. It says, everything is new tomorrow. Some man with a profound mind will have written that. Some man whose own name subsumes the tanka genre crosses to the limits of the novel, subsuming him. Some man will have written the tanka that is the quintessential Fleming sentence, which the post-Fleming titles of Bond films, like Tomorrow Never Dies, struggle to duplicate or parody. Sure, Bond replies, but then someone would interrupt the proceedings, reach for his sword, and demand one of the four occupied bedrooms. Bond's resistance, which takes the form of prosecuting certain claims to sublimation for the repression driving the stakes, nevertheless crosses over into the kind of intervention that presupposes identification. Everyone tries to forget his routed past instead of being proud of it. Then he concludes by overstepping his intervention and setting himself up for the backfire of breakthrough. You shouldn't try and pretend that your oldest whorehouse is a sort of Stratford-on-Avon. We are at the point of crossing over. The next round of literary chit-chat, which shows up Bond's ignorance of a certain 17th century haiku poet, prompts Tanaka to summon as many big names of Western literature as would fit into a hand of cards to bear witness to the enormity of this loss. Given out of chronological order, the shelf life of Western civilization is propped up by two bookends, Shakespeare and Goethe. Bond tries to be accommodating, but he cannot accept Tanaka's claim, based on several samples, that the unknown poet is Shakespeare's equal. Tanaka suggests that if Bond is to enter into an understanding of the haiku, he must try to compose one of his own. The result is Bond's authorship of the title of Fleming's narrative. You only live twice, once when you're born, once when you look death in the face. Tanaka is delighted with what he considers a breakthrough, a sincere effort that reflects on his mission. But it is not until they check into the local police station to look over surveillance shots of Dr. Shatterhand's castle that the breakthrough in fact occurs. One that exceeds the kamikaze therapy that aims at looking one's own death in the face. Bond's dead are now in his face, and the photographs he recognizes who's in this Dracula castle for keeps. Blofeld and Irma Bunt, the couple that is Spectre, now the ghost of his own couple's past, both his missing marriage and the couple of parents. He won't tell Tanaka who Dr. Shatterhand is. That would take the case out of his hands. The photographic evidence transmits to him the summons for revenge. Remember me. Under double cover in the fishing village from which he launches his covert operations against the Castle of Death, the locals refer to Dr. Shatterhand as a foreign body, both the devil himself and the incarnation of all the evil in the West. But local customs and shrines tend to make room for ghosts, many of them friendly. Bond encounters Blofeld on this questionable ground. And so, Mr. Bond, I came to devise this useful and essentially humane project, the offer of free death to those who seek release from the burden of being alive. By doing so, I have provided the common man with a solution to the problem of whether to be or not to be. Spectre appears at the juncture of questioning at which Hamlet encounters his Spectre. Is the ghost of his father, the dead father, doing the limbo because he has unfinished business to entrust to his son? Or is he a demon sent from hell? The infernal relation is never seriously pursued, but there is yet another question that is never raised as such, but which Hamlet acts out as his famous procrastination. What is the identity of, or the identification with, the ghost? Or put differently, has there been a murder, or is not the ghost of the father the strong sign that mourning at this juncture is disturbed, interrupted, abbreviated, and thus too successful by half, the vengeful, violent half? Isn't murder, in Shakespeare's play, with successful mourning and ready substitution inflicted upon the dead? There is the death of the other, but then there's the second death, which is murder. In Hamlet, there's no reason to trust the paternal ghost, who is otherwise the master of ceremonies at the pageant of second death. The secular mind was catching up with the goods of this world, which, since hardly good enough in comparison with what awaits us in the other world, were consigned in the Christian era to the trash heap of waiting around, or otherwise stored under projective layers of evil and demonization. Marlowe's Dr. Faustus steps up to this plate, sweet Mephistopheles, and during the 24 years or hour span of deathless consuming time, he gets to know the world of his own making. The medium for his striving is magic, a good catch-all for everything Christianity excluded and prosecuted. The world opens wide to him via magic. As secular subject, Faustus accepts the devil's best offer, a finite span of quality time, and then the deadline. He translates hell with Elysium, or with this world, and Christian devils with pagan demons or spirits of the dead. But once he binds himself to the most powerful devil magic can provide, Faustus must endure the sermonizing shine Mephistopheles takes to Christianity. The problem Faustus faces at or as the end is that he cannot be certain that there is a time limit to his death or afterlife. He knows that human striving, knowing, and consuming cannot be reduced to lifetime. His necromantic overskills made it possible for him to push button ghosts around as agents of long-distance travel and communication. Faustus does not want to slave as ghost for the next in line with an owner's manual. Focusing always only on his own death and life, Faustus must look forward to his own ghostliness as so abhorrent that it might as well be hell. Uninhibited by Christianity, Faustus gets his groove back, but he gets his grave back too. With Shakespeare's Hamlet, we get to know ghosts as the detour to self-knowledge missing from Faust's more direct and less protected hit of what's worth knowing. In Hamlet, the second death or life is thus subsumed by mourning, which in turn can be seen to replace the magic central to the tragical history of Dr. Faustus as the main medium for reopening the stage of the world following the withdrawal of Christianity's dominion. As was the case with magic in Dr. Faustus, the medium of mourning in Hamlet still includes fragments of the former Christian hierarchy as coordinates for steering the course of ghost communication and ghost making. The ghost of Hamlet's father explains his in-between state and schedule by the timing of his death. Without a timeout for absolution, he went down in the midst of his worldly life, falling short of ethical cleansing. Hamlet spares Claudius because he finds him at prayer, and thus in the ready position to let his soul fly straight to heaven and escape the full weight and waiting around of revenge. Dr. Faustus issues his ultimate affirmation of the secular world and word in his embrace of Helen of Troy, this first ending of Marlowe's tragical history, which the second ending takes back again, was where Goethe picked up Hamlet to steer his Faust clear of Christian doom to rescue. Too briefly, Marlowe's Faustus proclaims that his world is let go and recycled via Helen, and that all that is not Helen is what some still call hell. At the end of Goethe's Faust, unstoppable mourning, the eternal or internal feminine, stays the and between Helen and hell, Elysium and heaven, and cheats the Faustian deferral of suicide of its infernal punchline.